This week on Pop of Culture, we're in beautiful, luxurious Muncie.
After I finished editing the video, I said, this is the dumbest thing you've ever done, and almost didn't post it. And then I thought, what, for the 100 subscribers that I have, what's the difference? Just put it up there.
We'll talk to the creator of the popular online personality.
We'll also talk to the executive producer of a film hitting a big milestone.
And we'll listen to this week's beautiful thing.
And although alligators always look pretty menacing, these ladies look pissed.
That's coming up.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
From IPR, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. Stop me if you've heard this.
Welcome to beautiful, luxurious Muncie, Indiana. I'm your host of today's tour of Muncie, Ray Toffer. Let's begin, shall we?
Many people know a lot about beautiful, luxurious Muncie thanks to Ray Toffer, but we don't know much about the guy behind the popular videos. Ray, thanks for joining us today. Or wait a minute, I think I should say Stevie Hahn. Thanks for joining us today. Tell us about beautiful, luxurious Stevie.
Thank you so much for having me. This is quite the unique experience.
Tell me about yourself and your history with Muncie. Are you a native of Muncie? Did you travel? Tell us a little bit about you, Stevie.
Yeah, I've lived here my whole life. Yeah. I found it interesting when I first started studying at Ball State, and a lot of the kids would say, you're from here? And I would say, you paid to come here.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. So you grew up in Muncie. You went to Ball State. How did beautiful, luxurious Muncie come about?
Okay, so picture this. It's 2013. I was bored. I had many different characters at the time that weren't really hitting on YouTube. And so I put the glasses on and went out to the country and made a video. And then I woke up a couple of days later and it had 50,000 views. And sort of spiraled in more than a decade since then.
Wow. Talk about that first video. How did you land on this character, and what makes Ray so special? What was it about Ray that you think connected with audiences?
I wish I had an answer for that. None of this was planned.
Yeah.
After I finished editing the video, I said, this is the dumbest thing you've ever done, and almost didn't post it. And then I thought, what, for the 100 subscribers that I have, what's the difference? Just put it up there. And I'm not sure what it is, but I'll talk to my team about that and get back to you.
For those who have not seen a beautiful, luxurious Muncie video, and really shame on you, how would you describe your unique approach to the exploration of Muncie?
It's interesting that you say that. I've been criticized for making fun of Muncie, and have even been told that what I do makes Muncie look bad. But the truth is none of this was ever about Muncie. It's about this weird guy who's lost in middle America just trying to do his best.
Yeah.
Ray doesn't know why anyone wants to hear what he has to say, and he certainly doesn't know why anybody thinks he's funny.
You mentioned earlier that this is one of many characters. When did you land on, was this all comedy? Did you know, and how old were you when you decided, yeah, comedy is my thing, and you started to do that, and why video as the outlet?
Yeah, I started making videos when I was 5 years old.
Whoa.
My grandmother bought one of those giant over-the-shoulder VHS cameras,
yes,
and I stole it from her. And I've worked in all sorts of entertainment, from working at a radio show at WCRD to many years in theater. And then when YouTube came around, I realized that I could entertain people and make people laugh, which is all I ever wanted to do really in life, without the anxiety of being on stage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you done stage?
Oh, yeah.
Have you done the stand-up thing?
Not so much stand-up comedy. I've tried hosting a couple of gigs like that, and I've had to tell the people, be prepared for what I'm going to do to this audience, because it's not typical stand-up. You know, it's whatever it is that I do. But yeah, I worked at Muncie Civic for years, and then several years after that, just as like with a band and this family that did a lot of shows. And then the anxiety came, and I realized I could live behind a camera.
Oh, so talk a little bit about that. What is it about being behind a camera, being kind of in control on your own terms that makes it easier for you? Because I think a lot of people, if they see your videos, they probably assume, oh, he's funny. He's probably a real extrovert. He's, you know, out there and about doing things.
He is not.
He is not.
No, when we record these things, I mean, it's like ninja work. We pop in and pop out as fast as possible because I'm terrified of somebody recognizing me. I don't know why. Nothing bad ever happens. It's just something that is not wired properly in my head.
Talk a little bit about like where the ideas for the episodes of Beautiful Luxurious Muncie come from. Like whether it's kind of like the back rooms of Muncie or the different seasons. The seasons are my personal favorite because right now we're in spring. And what is it that you said is 80 degrees one day, 30 the next, and there's no in between.
That's correct. Just,
that's absolutely right. But talk a little bit about the process from idea to you getting in front of the camera.
So there are times when I'm like, uh-oh, don't have anything planned for this week. What am I going to do?
Yeah.
And I panic, and then it just comes. I mean, it writes itself. I open the notes app and just go crazy. And then after it's written, I call her, text her, and say, this is what we're doing. Actually, not usually. I usually don't tell you what we're doing. She picks me up, and we go.
We should probably point out that Augusta Isley is in the studio with us as a self-described emotional support human for Stevie. And speaking of other projects... let's talk a little bit about Survive Indiana.
Yeah.
Now for something completely different, yeah. Right?
Maybe I can talk about this. Survive Indiana is actually celebrating its 25th anniversary this year, believe it or not.
What?
I started doing this almost immediately after the first season of Survivor finished airing. So this started in like October of 2000.
What?
So yeah, it started as a themed birthday party and now it's a almost 30-person organization and I'm really proud of it.
Wow. I know people are probably familiar with Survivor, mm-hmm. the show, but talk a little bit about your take on it and the things that happen in your version of Survive.
Right. So I play Jeff Probst, mm-hmm. And we do a usually 10-person cast. We film the entire thing in one day from about 10 a.m. till just after sundown, and it's the entire game of Survivor crammed into one day. It's like a fun day camp activity for adults. But I take it very seriously. And yeah. I've been told that's why it's so funny is because it appears that I'm not in on the joke, which I'm not. I take it very seriously.
You do take it very seriously. And some of the games are complicated.
Yeah.
Like they'll start a game and there's like 75 steps. I don't know that I could follow that. Number one. Number two, by the end of the day, they have to be exhausted.
Oh, yeah. We all are.
I mean, there's no way.
We all hit about 30,000 steps that day.
Oh, my gosh. How do you cast Survive?
So it's mostly word of mouth from people who have played in the past. Wow. See, this Survive Indiana doesn't have anywhere close to the reach that I have in other venues. Mm-hmm. But I don't care about that. This is for me. And I try to do the best I can with the videos because it's for the contestants and their families to have this weird thing that they've done on YouTube, you know?
Absolutely.
And maybe someday when I'm long dead and gone, somebody will see it and be like, wow, this was great.
Yeah.
So this year I'm going to put some flyers out on campus. We're actually not filming until school is back in session for the first time ever.
Nice.
So that'll be part of my casting process. It's my least favorite part of the whole thing.
Is casting?
Yeah, because I don't have a person for that. I don't have a person for anything. Don't take offense to this. But like, when we're there, it looks like this big organization. But up until the day before and the day after, I do everything.
Oh my gosh.
And so it can be quite a lot.
Why do you do what you do?
Hold on. Let me see if I have something written down for that. Oh, a bottomless pit of needing attention.
Yeah.
Period.
Really? But needing attention on your terms. Like you said, I mean, if it's fine if it's on video, but you don't want people to recognize you in public and fawn all over you in public, right?
What?
He gets really, he's like little feathers. No, feathers.
Oh.
He just loves it.
You recognize him. Well, it's so interesting that you bring it up under my control. That's something that comes up in therapy quite a bit, is my control issues. I don't see the problem with it, and I'm trying to convince my therapist that it's not a problem, because if I don't control my environment to keep me happy, nobody else is going to do it.
That's right. Absolutely. And if you can, and you can do what you want and you enjoy, why not?
Right.
Why
and I not? Get to do this cool thing that nobody else gets to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What can we expect as the series continues? How many survive Indianas do you think you have in you?
I'm going to do it until I don't have a property to do it there anymore, and also I physically can't do it anymore.
Hmm. What's next for you as far as other projects on the horizon, other things that you have in your notes app that you're like, oh, I'd really like to do this?
Well, I have a lot of things for Ray, but believe it or not, between the Ray stuff and the Survive Indiana stuff, it's easily a part-time job. I started editing this season on October 1st, and it took about 5-6 hours a night, and I've taken 5 days off since then, and it's still not done.
Wow.
So it's comprehensive. I'm a slow editor, but I'm also a perfectionist when it comes to that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
As far as what's coming up for Ray, this next video that's coming out is actually one of my favorite things that we've ever done. We went to Indiana Comic Con and interviewed cosplayers. Well, Ray did.
Nice.
But the problem is that Ray Googled interview questions, and they're job interview questions, so they're not really questions that you would ask people at Comic-Con. So it's one of my favorite videos we've ever done.
So give me an example of a question that you asked a cosplayer that would not be necessarily appropriate to them, or
why do you want to work for this company? What is the most embarrassing thing you've ever done? That's not here. Hold on, I'll tell you. I've got it right here.
What are your strengths and weaknesses? Although depending on their character, that would apply.
Why are you so nervous? That was a big hit. am I making you uncomfortable?
Do you get nervous?
Yeah.
When you are interviewed? Yeah. Well,
yeah.
How do you deal with that when you're?
I really
someone?
Think that part of it is that I can't see through the glasses. So it's kind of like it's like claustrophobic almost.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you can't see who you're interviewing. They're just blurry because are they someone's old prescription?
Yeah.
What is it?
I don't know. They might have been my dad's.
Oh my
gosh. They sort of like sometimes when I'm editing, I'm like, oh my God, I look just like him. But I don't remember him ever wearing these big goofy glasses. So I don't know where they came. I have a whole closet that's full of costumes and props from a different part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And they came out of there. Just collection over the years.
So when can we see this new episode of Beautiful Luxurious Monty?
So I post every Sunday at 4 p.m. on TikTok. And then the videos come out on Instagram at 11 a.m. on Tuesdays. And I usually post a teaser on Friday mornings on Instagram for whatever I've been doing this week.
Yeah. And then you have the YouTubes. You have a YouTubes.
Yeah. So the Survive Indiana is exclusively on YouTube. So yeah, if you're a Survivor fan, check it out.
Awesome. So here's the final question.
Okay.
Do you like Muncie?
I have an interesting relationship with this place.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up here. This is my home. I feel better about it when I don't have people telling me that my work is making the place look bad.
Hmm.
Like I said, it's not about Muncie. It's about this weird guy who's lost in his life and just trying to find something to do. But yeah, I like it here. Listen, it could be worse.
True. Well, Stevie, thank you so much for taking time to come into the studio. We look forward to lots more Beautiful, Luxurious Muncie and Survive Indiana.
Thank you very much. And it's coming. Don't worry.
The documentary Ed Balls Century is celebrating 25 years this year. And here to talk about it is executive producer Nancy Carlson. Nancy, it's so great to have you in the studio for Pop of Culture.
Thanks for inviting me. It's hard to believe that this documentary is 25 years old. It seems like yesterday when we put it together.
Right? So tell me why you set out to do this documentary 25 years ago.
Actually, it started with Steve Bell, who's mm-hmm. now passed, and Jim Needham, who were both really good friends of Ed Ball. And they were seeing that Ed Ball was in his 90s and close to being 95. And they remarked that he'd been alive every decade of the 20th century. But they felt too close to him to do a documentary on him because it would be too one-sided. I mean, this is one of their best friends. And so they asked this mid-career girl at the TCOM department back then, it's called Media now, if I would be interested in writing a documentary on Ed Ball. And I was so shy, I said, oh, I don't even know him. And they said, that's the point.
Wow.
And so they introduced, I had done one other documentary on the author Jean Stratton Porter, who was long deceased, and she couldn't come back at me because she was dead. And here I was talking to probably one of the most important people in Muncie when it comes to philanthropy. So I met Ed, and he was a dear, dear person, and he agreed to allow me to dig around in the archives at Ball Brothers Foundation, and of course, Ball State University's archives, and lots of other places, including Leland, Michigan, which was their vacation spot. And I took on the job, and with the people at the Ball State Teleplex, as it was called back then. I don't know what it is now, but it was all those wonderful media guys. And they assigned Sam Clemens to be the videographer to go with me. And he really directed photography because we used lots and lots of stills. And together we embarked on a documentary that had an end date.
So how long of a process was this from start to finish? What are we talking in creating this documentary?
5 years, certainly.
Wow.
We had an end date of Ed's 95th birthday in January of 2000. And so here it is in the late 90s. So we got started. Now, I'll talk about Ed. He was born rich. So there were many, many photographs of him, maybe 14 baptismal photographs, for example. That family had movie cameras and still cameras before anybody else. So we had thousands of pictures to choose from. And so Sam directed all the photography and, of course, the videography. And I began to write the story. And the story is beautiful. As today, we sort of turn our noses up at billionaires who have all the money. But that isn't like the Ball family at all. Ed Ball's grandparents were humble farmers in New York. And Ed Ball's father was one of the five Ball brothers who were entrepreneurs. And so Ed Ball, I suppose, as a kid born rich, had to decide what he was going to do with his life. So first he wanted to go to college and be somebody, a lawyer or something like that. And then his parents and uncles, the Ball brothers, asked him if he'd come home and learn the business. Mm-hmm. Well, you can kind of imagine that was like, oh, really? Yeah. I wanted to strike out on my own.
Sure.
And he said, if I'm going to learn the business, I want to learn it on the factory floor. So he worked, his first couple jobs were on the factory floor getting to know the guys. What a brilliant idea, because he endeared himself to the lowest of workers at the factory. And then came the Depression, where the people had to give up half of their jobs to let an unemployed person take the other half. So everybody was sacrificing, including the Ball brothers themselves. And Ed was at the helm all this time. And that's what he gave up. He gave up a career in law or politics to run the Ball Corporation. So he was a great guy, not to mention all the philanthropy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Can you, for those who may be listening, maybe they are not familiar with the Ball family or the Ball brothers, could you talk a little bit about the importance of that family to this area and beyond, really?
Sure. Muncie was a backwoods town in the mid-1800s. And then, as many people know, someone discovered a pool of natural gas underneath this area, large area of Indiana, and the gas would sputter up free. And so there was a factory in New York that made glass jars, and sand is hard to melt, so you need a lot of firepower. So they up and moved to where the gas was free, and that became the beginning of Ball Brothers in Muncie. And a lot of other factories came, sure, too. But you who are listening are very familiar with the Ball Mason jars, canning jars, jars in bars where you drink beer out of, and that is the beginnings of the Ball Company. And they flourished during, yeah, the Depression because of home canning.
Absolutely.
So it's like when everyone else was suffering, this company was booming, even though the people were sharing jobs, the company itself was doing well. So if you've heard of Ball Jars, this is the family. If you've heard of Ball Hospital, this is the family.
Yes.
If you've heard of Ball State University, this is the family that started it. And Ed was a second generation.
Yes, absolutely. Nancy, looking back on the documentary and all of the interviews that you conducted, are there any that like still today, like really stand out, those moments that just kind of still get you?
Yes. From the documentary? I interviewed Virginia Ball, Ed's second wife, mm-hmm, on the shores of Lake Michigan up at Leland. And she had silver hair, and her hair was blowing in the wind, and it was not tucked into the usual French roll that was so tight and pretty at, mm-hmm, in Muncie, but she was so free. And she told me a little secret that Ed would never have told me because he was way too modest. But she says Ed would get up every morning and say to himself or to Virginia, "Well, what good can I do today?" And he never would have told me that because he was way, way too modest. So that was my favorite interview. But I have a regret. I never got to interview one of the five children. The children, too, were shy and unassuming and modest. And one of the guys, Robert Ball, would not do an interview with
me. Really?
And I was so sad. He was in Europe. I think he's a specialist in hot stone massage. Uh-huh. I forget what it's called, but yeah. Reiki or, yes, something like that. And he would not interview. He was too shy. And so I shot pictures of his house and pictures of his boyhood, but I never got the man. But he did come. We had a soft opening of the documentary up in the Leland area, and he came to the performance, and he wasn't in it, so it's his own fault.
Yeah.
but I regretted not having the son. And also, I didn't get much on one of Ed's sisters. Of course, one sister, Janice Ball, lived in Muncie.
Right.
So it was easy for me to interview her, but one of the other sisters had passed away, so I didn't get much details on that.
So if you're listening right now and you're thinking, oh, I would really like to see this documentary, well, lucky you, there's an opportunity to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the making of the documentary. And Nancy, can you tell us a little more about this event?
Yes, it will be open to the public at Minnetrista Museum and Gardens at 7 o'clock on Friday, May 2nd. Now, that's the day before commencement, so there'll be lots of people in town. Hopefully, yeah, you will be in town to see this film, and some of the filmmakers that worked on this will be there to talk to.
Wonderful. Nancy, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
Nancy Carlson is, among many other things, the executive producer of Ed Ball's Century. The documentary turns 25 this year. This is Pop of Culture. I'm Michelle Kinsey.
I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Jen Blackmer. River Teeth is a biannual journal of nonfiction narrative. That means creative essays that draw on the writer's personal experiences, often crossing the divide between stories and poetry. River Teeth Journal has a weekly online magazine called Beautiful Things, full of what the journal calls micro essays. and we're going to share one with you now. We are speaking with writer and instructor at Brevard College, Lindsay Farr. Hello, Lindsay. Welcome to our program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Where are you joining us from?
I am in my little cabin outside of Asheville, North Carolina.
And when you say little cabin, is it a little cabin? I mean, is it kind of in the middle of nowhere?
Literally a little cabin and kind of in the middle of nowhere. It's not quite an A-frame. It's rickety and glorious, and I've lived in it for 5 years now.
That sounds fantastic, actually, especially for a writer. It seems like it would be a great place to do your work.
It is.
Well, speaking of your work, tell us a little bit about it. What types of things do you write?
Interestingly enough, I really, in my heart of hearts, I want to write fiction, but I never can quite get over how strange life is. And so I found myself writing creative nonfiction and loving it. I love the membrane between it and poetry. I feel like it mimics the way my brain works.
Absolutely. And the great thing about this particular segment in our collaboration with River Teeth is that that's what River Teeth focuses on, is creative nonfiction. And that sort of blending of genres, as you say, between poetry and essay and observations. And tell us about the piece you're going to share with us today. It's called We Call Up Danger Only to Send It Away.
Yes. So this little micro essay was found, it went through several different iterations until it found its truest form, distilled down into this micro essay. And it's a scene from my early 20s, I would say, in my hometown of Jackson, Mississippi.
Awesome. All right. Well, let's hear it. This is Lindsay Farr's essay, We Call Up Danger Only to Send It Away.
I can call them, you know. Call who? The gators. Bull. In response, Joe lifted the trolling motor with one tattooed arm. Then he winked at me and started making these beeping noises in the back of his throat. No sound floated on the Pearl River but the whine of mosquitoes and Joe's space invader laser chirps. I watched the black water for movement, my lukewarm beer forgotten. Nothing. A fish jumped. Far off bumps broke the glassy surface and cruised towards us. Then more bumps. Then more, like a stealthy flotilla of logs or alligators. Only females respond to the chirps made by their hatchlings, and although alligators always look pretty menacing, these ladies look pissed. Soon, we were surrounded by a dozen alligators, all over 6 feet long. I found myself acutely aware of just how tiny this little bass boat was, how thin its sparkly red fiberglass hull. Joe beamed at me. The gator's eyes peered up at us, unblinking. Now what? I asked. You wanted to see some alligators. Now you want them to go away? Make up your mind, baby girl. He lit a Marlboro and exhaled, smiling down at the gators indulgently as if each one was his precious, deadly baby. He looked the same way at me sometimes. I was the closest thing to a daughter he ever got. Then he reached down with his palm and slapped the water hard. Every pair of eyes disappeared, returning the surface to glass once more.
Wow. Oh, Lindsay, that was awesome.
Thank you.
I think the thing that I responded to as I was listening, there were two things actually, but the first thing I want to talk about is the suspense this builds up, right? I think there's several details where you are talking about, you know, the glassy eyes looking up and then the boat feeling really small.
Yeah, it was, I remember like just pulling away from the side of the boat, like that's going to do any good.
Right. And then this, you wanted to see some alligators and here they are. The other thing that is quite impactful about this is just the level of detail that puts us in the middle of this scene. And it really, you're using so much sensory detail that I'm feeling the humidity and I'm hearing the conversation and the stuff in the background, and then you say he lit a Marlboro and it's and I'm just so there. Your use of detail is really compelling.
Thank you.
Yeah, how do you do that? Do you just, as you're working on the piece, do you just recall what you were thinking about? Do you try and put yourself back there? Yeah. How did you do it?
I mean, this scene is etched onto my soul forever. It was that memorable. And also it's I find that when we have memories that we treasure, you know, sometimes we can pull them out and look at them and roll them around in our palms until they become kind of dulled. And so I find that writing short creative nonfiction to be kind of a gift to my own memory, in that here it is in its most concentrated crystalline form, mm-hmm. and it will never be dulled. I can't forget it now.
Right. That's lovely and very true. And one of the interesting things you do here as well is give us the memory in its kind of contradictory form too, right? That it's not like you just want to gloss it over and say, oh, this was a lovely day. That in fact, you know, it was a small boat and you're surrounded by, quote, ladies who look pissed, unquote, right? And it's a gorgeous memory, but it's also kind of precarious, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're surrounded by alligators looking at you like, okay, where are the babies?
Yeah, I know, and like your lunch, right? What happened next? Am I allowed to ask that? I don't know if I'm allowed to ask that. What happened next?
Yeah, I mean, like when it was kind of amazing, like and you know, there's that everything, time kind of stopped for a second, you know,
yeah.
And the violence of the gesture when he like reached down and just popped.
Yeah.
You know, flat-handed the top of the water, and they literally vanished.
Oh, which is fascinating and creepy at the same time, because you know they're still there, right?
You know, and then we just, you know, he put the trolling motor back in the water and off we went, you know?
Yeah. Wow. What, Lindsay, what are you working on now?
That's a great question. What I'm working on now is I did a residency in a dune shack outside of Provincetown, Massachusetts, out in Cape Cod.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am going through a lot of the kind of sketches that I ended up doing up there and fleshing those out. So right now I'm writing a thing about humpback whales and how they have lungs the size of Priuses.
Yeah. And I'm getting a theme here, which is sort of water life, you know, and that, and it's weird. I mean, there's the division between life in the water and life on land, and we encounter them. And, you know, what is that about? Priuses, lungs the size of Priuses.
That's what, you know, I was on one of those whale watching tours,
yeah.
And they have the, a naturalist on board telling you all of these facts, you know, about the whales around you. And they're like, yeah, their lungs are the size of Priuses. I was like, that's such a strange comparison.
Strange comparison, and yet it's specific. And here we are talking about it. That's great. Lindsay Farr is a writer and an instructor at Brevard College. She lives in a cabin in the woods, which I would love to be able to do. And she shared her beautiful thing with us. We call up danger only to send it away here on Pop of Culture. Lindsay, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
This story comes from IPR's collaboration with River Teeth's Beautiful Things. a weekly magazine of micro essays. More at riverteethjournal.com. I'm Jen Blackmer.
I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. It's Pop of Culture. I'm Michelle Kinsey.
And I'm Kara Duquette. It's time to ask another artist, what are you working on?
We are here today with Dr. Sarah Coyes, who is an assistant teaching professor of sociology at Ball State University, as well as an ensemblage artist, just to name a couple of the things Sarah does. I would like to thank you for being here today, Sarah.
Thank you.
And also, I want to ask you today one of our favorite questions, which is, what are you working on? And with you, I'm going to qualify that question to hone it into the visual arts for us.
Well, I'm working on creating cards with recycled materials, including the New Yorker, which I love to use their images. And I'm also doing collages or assemblages. I like how you pronounce it, though, Kara. Assemblages.
I was trying to be fancy.
I have to do that, too. which I do collages on recycled materials, including old card boxes, any recycled material, really.
Great. Where do you find these materials?
Well, my mother collected the New Yorker and other magazines for about three decades. And I've been collecting magazines also for about the last two decades. So I have a lot of material to work with. I didn't know that what I was doing for the last 20 years was called assemblages or assemblages until I watched the documentary called Women Art Revolution in Canopy. And there was artist Betty Saar, an African-American artist who is 94, who has been doing assemblages for the last seven decades. And I thought, wow, I've been doing this too. And I have actually assigned my students in my music and art and society class to do assemblages, which I really loved their projects.
And I know that you're a writer and you're an activist, so I would like to know what some of the issues are that spark your assemblage.
Well, I always want my collages to be inclusive of images of women, inclusive of images of LGBT people. I don't want the images only to be of white people. I want people of color in the images. So I really make an effort to be as inclusive as possible. I used to sell my art at the Cornerstone Center for the Arts, and I remember a young student noticed that all of the collages included images of African Americans, and that's important for my work.
Mm-hmm. I read that you teach about hip-hop. And does that come into your collage work as well?
Yes, I do love images of celebrities, but performers, musical performers. But I don't like using images that are fabricated in terms of makeup or these fake smiles. I really like images of people that aren't smiling, that are serious, not photoshopped, to the extent where you really lose the reality.
Mm. So when you talk about makeup, you're not talking about someone wearing makeup, are you? Are you talking about the manipulation through the computer?
Yes.
Of imagery?
The photo shoots or the photo
photoshopping. Okay. Interesting.
But in terms of how the sociology of hip-hop class or course that I designed, again, I want it to be inclusive, but I do like including some images of celebrities and not for every collage or artwork, but definitely I'm drawn to celebrity, like a lot of people are right now.
What's some of the favorite things that you like to collage?
Well, I had a commissioned work to create about 200 holiday cards for a well-known person.
Oh.
But I can't mention their name.
I won't press.
I did holiday cards, about, I think, 150. I thought, oh, I'm going to finally get noticed for my artwork. One of these celebrities that received my collage card and envelope, they're going to commission me to do more work. And guess what happened? Mm-hmm. No one contacted me for further work.
Hmm.
Darn it. I thought it would like catapult me to stardom, and it didn't.
Well, let me ask you about your cards. I know you like to tackle social issues, and that is a foundational part of your person. But were these cards in that realm, or were they in a different zone?
I had to submit a, I guess, test card, and I had included images of real people and what I thought represented a holiday theme. But the person who I was doing the work for wanted more kind of generic holiday images. So I went to the thrift store and bought some holiday images from books. But in terms of the societal issues, I did try to be inclusive of the holiday in cards, including images from Hanukkah, such as the menorah, images from Christmas, including images of Santa, well, reindeers. But as I said, the person who commissioned me to do this work didn't like the first sample I gave them.
Commissions
are
tough.
Or maybe they didn't, it's not that they didn't like them, but they wanted more holiday images.
Yeah. Commissions are a difficult thing. It's not something I've done a lot of because you really have to sometimes change track. Now, is there something else you want to tell us about today regarding your art?
My art has been really therapeutic. I began doing my collages when I would go visit my mother in Cleveland, Ohio, because as I said, she had hundreds of old New Yorkers, and she was also a prolific card writer. Hmm. But she could talk for hours. And I would sit in the living room and listen to her, and I thought, I got to do something. And I started getting her card boxes that were empty and collaging them with her New Yorkers. And I began to give them as gifts, and 20 years later, I'm still doing it.
I can just imagine you doing that, and as she's speaking, you know, what she's saying is like, you know, working on your subconscious as you're collaging. Well, art makes our lives more beautiful every day. And thank you so much for making our afternoon a little brighter.
Well, thank you for this opportunity for me to share my art.
Kara, it's that time again. It's time for the calendar. Let's see what's going on in and around this lovely area. Muncie's Arbor Day celebration begins at 9 a.m. Saturday, April 26th at Minnetrista Museum and Gardens. Participate in informative tree and sapling planting demonstrations, express your creativity at craft stations, and choose your own sapling from a selection of oaks, sycamores, bald cypress, sweet gum, tulip trees, redbuds, and so much more. Minnetrista.net has more info.
Oh, I want to get a tree.
Yes.
Sit down. You're rocking the boat. Guys and Dolls will take the stage this weekend at Mitchell Theater on Taylor University campus in Upland. The show will continue through May 4th. Taylor.edu has more details.
The Human Library will be open Sunday, April 27th at the Oakhurst Home on the Minatrista campus. At the Human Library, every book is a person with a lived experience to share. Sit down for a half-hour conversation, ask questions, and challenge your own perspective. Check out one or as many as you have time for. The event begins at 1 p.m.
Okay, have you gone to the Human Library?
I have. It's a wonderful experience.
It really is.
And it is one of those things where you start to have a conversation, you're like, oh, I want to talk for hours.
Yeah.
But yeah, and that's why you see a lot of people going back to the different Human Library experiences so that they can check out more books. It truly is a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Yeah, it's transformative. The Miracle Worker is on stage this weekend at the Commons Theater in Alexandria. The show will be Friday through Sunday, April 25th through the 27th.
Ball State's Campus Band and Wind Ensemble will perform at 7:30 p.m. Friday, April 25th at Sursa Performance Hall, and the Ball State Cardinal Chorus, Choral Union, Concert Choir, and Vox Anima will perform Saturday, April 26th at Sursa Performance Hall. Showtime is 7:30.
Ball State Theater and Dance students will present their spring choreography projects this weekend in the Coast Guard Dance Studio at Ball State. Shows will be Friday and Saturday, April 25th and 26th. BSU.edu/theater has more information.
And looking ahead, next Thursday is First Thursday in downtown Muncie. I can't believe it's already going to be May. I cannot believe it. It's a chance to check out new exhibits at downtown galleries and shops. Check out the Makers Market and the Songwriter Sessions at Cornerstone Center for the Arts and much more. The fun begins at 5 p.m.
If you have something fun Pop of Culture listeners need to know about, go to indianapublicradio.org/contact, then click Pop of Culture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
And that's our show. Our fact checker and shadow producer is Stephanie Weekman, and our regular producer is Luke Jones, who barely survives every show with us. Our show is hosted by me, Michelle Kinsey.
And me, Kara Duquette. Pop of Culture is a production of IPR on the beautiful campus of Ball State University.
You may go first. Or do you want to go first?
I want to say beautiful, luxurious Muncie.
Then go for it.
This week on Pop of Culture, we're in beautiful, luxurious Muncie.